singing the song and keeping in tune. One of my granddaughter Hannah's favorite videos is the original version of How the Grinch Stole Christmas from the story of the same name by Dr. Seuss. In fact, she was still watching this in June when we were asked by her parents to, when she visited us on Mondays, keep that video locked up. She loved it so much. Many of you are familiar with the story of how the Grinch, determined to prevent Christmas from coming to Whoville, enters all the homes on Christmas Eve and steals the gifts and the goodies and strips all the decorations from the Christmas trees because he wants to prevent Christmas from coming. And he is stunned, however, when the Whos awaken on Christmas morning and they gather in a circle in the middle of town and they begin to sing this wonderful song of praise. Now, there's no doubt that the Whos felt deeply disappointed. I'm sure they were distraught at what they saw in the morning in their empty houses and their stripped trees. And on their own, they may have despaired. Certainly, songs of joy would not have erupted from their mouths. And yet they found the community of Whoville such power in gathering together to sing that voices which might have been more prone to weep were raised in song. Their song and the fact that they could sing was because of what was in their hearts that gave them such a witness, or gave such a witness to the Grinch, that his heart grew exponentially that day and his life changed such that he too joined the song. From its earliest days, the Christian church has been a community which sings. It began, after all, with a group of Jewish converts who had behind them a great tradition of song. We heard an example this morning. In fact, we heard two. We heard Judy's rendition of a psalm, and we heard our responsive psalm, 111. Great are the works of the Lord. He is faithful and full of compassion. His commandments are sure. His covenant lasts forever. And they sang it. They didn't just say it. The occasions for music were varied. Harvesting in the vineyards and the fields, weddings and funerals, religious festivals, and of course, above all, worship in the temple. And the first Christians brought this very rich tradition and memory into their fellowship. Jews and Christians are people who sing. It comes then as no surprise to hear the Apostle Paul say, "Be filled with the Spirit, speaking to yourselves in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing and making melody in your heart to the Lord." One of the earliest non-Christian documents about the early Christians that we have a copy of was written by Pliny the Younger to the Emperor Trajan about 110 in the Common Era, and it reads this: "The Christians are accustomed to come together on a stated day before sunrise and to sing hymns in turn to Christ as to a God." For 2,000 years, Christians have met to sing, the music manifesting a great variety of form and style, from the plain song of the earliest centuries to today's praise choruses. By the time of the Reformation, the music of the liturgy had become quite complicated, and the music was sung in Latin, effectively robbing the congregation, who neither read nor spoke Latin, robbing the congregation of its voice. Singing was left to the choir. It is no wonder, then, is it, that the people's grasp of the gospel was poor. Now, Martin Luther was a musician as well as a theologian, and he wrote, "After theology, it is to music that I give the first place and the highest honor." He said he was determined to give the people back their voice. He also added that he believed the devil shouldn't have all the pretty tunes. So Luther wrote 37 hymns, the best of which is in almost all our hymnals, a mighty fortress is our God, a bulwark never failing. And by the time he died, over 60 collections of hymns had been published. The Bible was published in the language of the people, and its central message was committed to song and hymn. And 2 centuries later came the great Wesleyan revival under John the Preacher and Charles the hymn writer. And much of the success of that remarkable revival that followed John's preaching has to be attributed to the singing of Charles' hymns. Many of the people were illiterate, couldn't read, but they could sing, they could memorize, and they did. And these hymns, taken together, express the essence of Christian doctrine. Their major note is joy and confidence. Christ the Lord is risen today. Hark, the herald angels sing. Rejoice, the Lord is King. 6,500 hymns, Charles Wesley wrote. Now, I'm sure they weren't all good. They haven't all survived. We don't still sing them all, but we sing a great many of them. And someone has written, these hymns, composed by the Wesleys, were composed in order that men and women whom Hogarth, the painter, depicted in his terrible pictures, might sing their way not only into experience, but also into knowledge, that the culture might have their culture baptized and the ignorant might be led into truth by the gentle hand of melody and rhyme. Now, you'll be forgiven for thinking this is all sounding like a history lesson. It's not my intention. My intention is to highlight the importance given to music, particularly hymns, by the giants of our faith, by the Apostle Paul, by Martin Luther, and the Wesleys. Hymns change over time, but they're all variations on the theme. Now today, communal singing is rarer and rarer. In fact, I read in the paper yesterday that Rotary and Kiwanis are struggling to attract new members, younger members. And they thought that changing the rules a little bit might make that a possibility. So in is flexible memberships and night meetings, and out is mandatory attendance and goofy sing-alongs. Now, I have never been a member of Rotary or Kiwanis, so I didn't know they had goofy sing-alongs, but apparently they're out. Once it was not uncommon for people to sing at large civic and public events. Now even ballparks play a recording of Take Me Out to the Ball Game. And the national anthem has been assigned to some celebrity soloists, and we sit and listen. Once children regularly sang and learned the traditional songs of our culture in school. I know I did. Some schools have done away with singing altogether, with the exception maybe of the national anthem on the PA system in the morning. But people still love music, of course. But much of it comes directly to an individual ear through an iPod or other personal music devices. So how does our church see music? Is it something to uplift, to encourage, to teach, to connect us to one another, as Paul intended when he wrote to the Ephesians? Communal singing may be rare and getting rarer these days, but it is just as vital as it was in the first century and before that in the people of Israel. Worship, which includes our singing together, strengthens and unites congregations. It connects us to our history. It brings us together in the present with hope for the future. Singing increases our joy and encourages us when we are sorrowing or uncertain. We were hiking up Table Mountain in Cape Town last spring, Arnold and I, with our son, and we heard this lovely music somewhere just ahead of us. Voices singing in harmony. And as we rounded a bend, there was a work crew. men and women in orange overalls singing a hymn. We recognized the tune, singing a hymn during a lunch break. And I couldn't help but wonder how music had no doubt sustained and comforted and encouraged them and their brothers and sisters through long years of oppression, and continues to lift them. Music clearly carries God's Spirit, especially music shared communally, as that simple children's story by Dr. Seuss illustrates so well. Now, I'm very certain there's someone here this morning who is saying, "But I just can't sing." Now, Brian Wren, the contemporary hymn writer, paraphrases one of his editors who said, in response to that very same complaint, "I can't sing," "The crucial question is not, do you have a voice, but do you have a song? It's not, can you sing, but will you make a joyful noise?" I remember last year when Lorraine Pierce's brother died, and she was helping to put together the funeral service, and she said, "He loved all hymns. It wasn't hard to choose hymns that he loved. He couldn't sing a note, but he sang at the top of his voice." You don't have to be good. You can make a joyful noise. But the important question is, do we have a song? The tune of which we all know if we're going to sing together in harmony. And I think it's less and less certain that we do, even in the church. Reginald Bibby is the Canadian sociologist who has spent a lot of time looking at the question of religion in Canada. And in his book, Fragmented Gods, he writes of people who consider themselves Christian, but he says many of them approach their spiritual journey as artisans working on a bricolage. A little bit of gospel language here, a little bit of Celtic wisdom there, and a little bit of karma in the sun. Now, I want to be careful to say that we need to guard against the uncharitable assumption that truth is not found in non-Christian writings. Christians are not the only ones with insight into the human spirit, and different human traditions will have wisdom to offer us. God's Spirit blows according to God's will. But I think Christians need to be on guard against a simple drift into the contemporary consumer mindset that's represented by someone else that Bibby quotes, Andrew Walker, who declares, "Nobody forces a version of religion on us anymore. There are varieties on sale, vying for our attention, but we, the consumers, have absolute power." And then there are those attempts at spiritual truth that play off the content of the Christian faith, that is, doctrine and teaching, against personal spiritual experience. And you know what? It seems to me, so I talk to people like this all the time, experience trumps all the time, because somehow doctrine is passé, if not dead. It's thought to be dead and deadly, constricting, exactly. And for the person who has had disappointing experiences in the churches, or who can identify religion, as we all can these days, with acts of violence, an array of custom-made spiritualities seems enticing. Perhaps, but none of these is the church's song. The tune carried on through the ages and revealed in the biblical story. And that story speaks to us with the same power that it spoke to our fathers and mothers, and whose lives are recorded in the pages of the book. And then we are led by that same Spirit that says we too must live our lives in the fearful, faithful search for the will of God who made us and the love of Christ that saves us. It does not mean that with the biblical story, particularly as it comes to us in Jesus, the God-man who has lived and died and risen and ascended so that his life might be shared with each of us, it does not mean that our work is done, but only beginning. In the penetrating light of that word, of that song, if you will, we must now live our lives just as our ancestors did, working out our own salvation with fear and trembling. When the pilgrims were setting off for America, one of their theologians, John Robinson, said to the gathered company, "The Lord has more light and truth yet to break forth out of his holy word." Was that not true? The song is often sung with new nuances, variations again on the theme. What must the truth be now if men, and it was mainly men, it was men who wrote it, who thought it, what must the truth be now if men who thought as they did put it like that, before quarks and black holes, before Auschwitz and ecosystems, the word, the gospel, our song, was the true tune, the true light, shining through the darkness, and it still is. And we will find this truth that Paul says keeps us wise and able to discern in this shadowed and complex age, a time when absolutely no support is given to our faith from the culture around us, which is militantly secular. So we need to come together to worship in song and in word, so that together we might learn to carry this tune to the end of our days. This is the task of each and every one of us. Amen.